Good morning. This is a meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee, and we'll come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 15th. The time is 8:03 a.m. Present, making quorum, are Representative Fakatak, Representative Drummond, Representative Frox, Representative McCabe, Representative Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. Today we will be taking, I really can't read my script. It's a little early because we had a long night. I'd like to thank our House Records Secretary, Lori Rowland, and our LIO moderator, Talia Eames, for assisting the committee this morning. Before we begin, I'll remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. We will be taking up today House Bill 256, Law Enforcement Registry of Force. That'll be our second hearing on that. And we will be taking public testimony. We'll have a first hearing of House Bill 298, the Alaska Food Strategy Task Force. And we will start with that this morning, the introduction of House Bill 298 by Representative Snyder and her staff, Ms. Wiggin. So please come to the table and introduce yourselves.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We made it. We were just here. Okay. Thank you, Chair Hannon. Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. And thank you to the other members of the committee for the opportunity to present on HB 298, an act establishing the Alaska Food Strategy Task Force. For the record, my name is Rep. Liz Snyder, and I represent the best parts of East Anchorage. I am really excited this morning, even if I'm trying to get my energy level back up from last night, but I am really excited about all the positive energy right now around improving food security and growing our local food economies. From the Governor's Food Security and Independence Task Force, created through Administrative Order 331, to the Food and Farm Caucus here in this legislature, of which I'm a proud member, and now HB 298, which I'm bringing to you today, which is designed to facilitate this good work into the years ahead. And I anticipate we may have questions comparing the governor's task force to what HB 298 proposes to do, and I'll look forward to diving into that more in questions if that's helpful. I'm also excited to bring this bill before you today on a personal and professional note, if you'll let me highlight a little bit of what motivated me to put this bill together in collaboration with many stakeholders. Food security and local food economy development, it's near and dear to my heart. It was one of my primary focus areas in my research and teaching at UAA before coming to the legislature. So I think you can understand my passion around the issue. There I had the incredible privilege of teaching courses on Alaska's food systems, creating professional development opportunities to grow Alaska food systems, and advising students on master's thesis projects in which they worked with community partners in the field all across the state on a variety of topics, including agricultural land classification and mapping, local food business plan development, community and local foods needs assessment, vertical drip irrigation, food production, urban farming, analysis of foodborne illness, nutrition assistance programming, impacts of tourism on subsistence caribou harvest, and national and international food systems policy analysis and adaptation, just to name a few. And I just highlighted that list to draw focus on what we're talking about when we're talking about food systems and food security. It really is a very diverse topic, a broad and far-reaching topic, and something that requires a lot of attention by a lot of different stakeholders and areas of expertise. And it was an incredible and endlessly educational experience there at the university, but also one that continually highlighted the need for a comprehensive statewide food strategy. We have so many challenges. I know many of us are familiar with many of them, but also so many opportunities. And a piecemeal or a strictly reactive or a short-term response to grow our food system won't be enough. The ability to strategically prepare and implement a plan to build our food independence is paramount, which has only been further highlighted over the past two challenging years and in the face of international conflict with far-reaching implications. The governor, he nailed it, I think, in his State of the State address earlier this year that we were all at on the floor, and it bears repeating here. We import 95% of our food, and that's an estimate. We actually don't have a hard and fast calculation. That's a number that's just been accepted because it's been so widely circulated for several years. But it's about right. It's definitely in the high 90s. And it's at a cost, and that's, we're talking about commercial food, not wild-caught food here in the state. But that commercial food is a, we spend about $2 billion each year, and we hear that number quite a bit. Again, that's an estimate. Each year, and we've only got about a week of food when we look at the store shelves. If our supply chains break down, we are in dire straits very quickly if we don't have alternative ways to procure our food. And we're currently vulnerable due to what we would call, we could call, our reverse pipeline as it pertains to food. But we wouldn't have to direct $2 billion out of state a year if we better utilized our significant resources and expertise toward production and distribution of food and the continuation of thousands of years of subsistence practices within Alaska. And we wouldn't have to wonder if a natural disaster, be it earthquake or pandemic, will cut us off from the lower 48 ports and therefore food for most of our population in the state. We have the resources to grow our food-related economic sectors and move towards greater Alaskan self-reliance. We just need to focus our efforts, and that's what HB 298 and in conjunction with some of our other efforts in the building and across the state, aims to do. So a little bit of detail here before I hand it over to Ms. Wiggin, my staff member, to go over the sectional. But the task force will present state policy, legislation, and implementation strategy recommendations in six integrated focus areas. One, sustainably growing the agriculture industry. We had a really productive mariculture task force that operated for about 6 years, producing some fantastic recommendations and some concrete outcomes, including two bills that we could reference this morning just to, as a starter. That was 6 years of work focused on the mariculture industry. I think it'd be really great in this bill to also provide some intense focus on the ag industry. Two, sustainably growing markets for locally grown, locally harvested, and locally processed foods. Three, enhancing the climate for food and beverage businesses. Four, minimizing food waste and diverting it from the waste stream. And food waste in and of itself is a very valuable, precious resource if we think about it in that way. Five, improving connectivity, efficiencies, and outcomes in state-run programs affecting food availability and access. And six, ensuring food security in rural and urban communities. I'll wrap up by highlighting that this bill was created in partnership with stakeholders such as the Alaska Food Policy Council, the Alaska Food Bank, and the Alaska Farm Bureau. I shared a draft of this bill with chairs from the Farm and Food Caucus back in December, and feedback from all of these stakeholders was incorporated into the piece of legislation that you have before you today. The executive board of the task force on HB 298 will be comprised of members of the Food Policy Council, which, if you are not familiar with the Food Policy Council, depending on the year and the makeup, they have members from ranging from farmers to educators at the university to local food business owners to former USDA nominees, the whole gamut of representation across the state in terms of expertise and geography, and they've been doing better and better as the years have gone by. And then it also includes four members of the state legislature on that executive board. Other members of the task force will include commissioners of state departments and a varying selection of community members in fields related to the task force's focus areas. And wrap up, HB 298 is designed to be part of the solution for Alaska's food system and security challenges through comprehensive engagement between policymakers and community members, folks on the ground doing this work every day. It will provide policy, legislation, implementation strategy recommendations, as I said earlier, crafted by those on the ground, focused on strengthening Alaska's food systems and improving food security for the long-term benefit of Alaska's community, economy, and environment. And with that, Co-Chair Hannon, if I may, I would turn it over to Ms. Wiggin.
And I'm going to just pause for a second to make sure that the please let the record reflect that Representative McCarty joined us at 8:06. All right, Ms. Wiggins, go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Arielle Wiggins, staff to Representative Snyder. HB 298 changes the uncodified law of the state of Alaska. Section 1 adds intent language for why we should establish the Alaska Food Strategy Task Force. Section 2 adds a new section describing the composition and function of the task force. Subsections A through D detail the composition of this 35-member task force. There will be a 9-member executive board made up of 5 members of the Alaska Food Policy Council selected by their governing board, 4 members of the legislature, 2 from the Senate, 2 from the House, 1 from the minority of either body. The additional 26 members will be comprised of commissioners or their designees from the Department of Natural Resources, Fish and Game, Health and Social Services, Commerce and Education and Early Development, for a total of 5. 21 members, including but not limited to individuals representing the mariculture and fisheries industries, agriculture, the University of Alaska, hunger and nutrition organizations, Alaska tribal governments or intertribal organizations, food distribution, and general economic development, will make up the rest of the task force. Subsections E through I provide general guidance for board governance on how and when members are selected, how and when meetings are held, subjecting the task force to the Open Meetings Act, and it includes provisions for removal of members if they've missed more than 2 meetings per calendar year or have not been contributing in a meaningful way to the activities of the task force. Subsections J through M provide guidance for the task force to create advisory committees on 6 areas and provide further instruction on what must be included in the final report. The 6 focus areas, as described by Representative Snyder, are sustainably growing the agriculture industry, sustainably growing markets for locally grown, locally harvested, and locally processed foods, enhancing the climate for food and beverage businesses, minimizing food waste and diverting it from the waste stream, improving connectivity, efficiencies, and outcomes in state-run programs affecting food availability and access, and ensuring food security in rural and urban communities. Subsection O requires the task force to submit a report on recommendations for half of the focus areas by August 1st, 2023, and half by August 1st, 2024 to the appropriate officials, and they must notify the legislature that it is available. Section 3 instructs the task force to begin work as soon as the majority of members have been selected, and Section 4 repeals Sections 1 and 2 on June 30th, 2025, effectively ending the task force. Section 5 adds an immediate effective date under AS 01-020-070C. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannah. Could you go through the Food Policy Council again for me? Who falls on that, where they come from, how they're selected? It sounds like we're selecting people that were already selected. So I'm just curious if it's...
Sure.
I missed it when you said that, I think.
Absolutely. So the Alaska Food Policy Council, it's our only statewide food policy focused nonprofit organization. Its roots date back to about 2009, 2010 through a CDC grant administered through the Department of Health and Social Services when they began brainstorming about what this organization should look like, what it should do, and what its first goals were. And from that day, and it's improved since, but it's been very broad representation on there. And I can't speak to the very early days before I had knowledge of the organization in terms of how people joined the board. But now folks apply and the existing governing board reviews those, looking for gaps in their expertise, looking for gaps in their geographic representation. Right now, to the best of my recollection, there are folks on that board from local food business, from rural community development organizations, from former USDA appointees, the executive director of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and I could pull it up and I could send you a complete list. I think they list it online. And those terms vary. I believe, again, I may not have my total facts straight, but I believe 2 to 4 years, and they may be an opportunity to renew one time. Did I answer your question?
No.
Okay.
Yes, but no.
But more. Representative.
Follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So through the chair, mm-hmm. How is it different? How is this different from that?
Sure.
And why don't we just strengthen that so we don't have to do this?
Right. I think there's a couple answers on that. So the Alaska Food Policy Council focuses on not just creating a statewide food policy strategy. And in fact, I think there's been a history of them wondering if they should change their name, because when you see the Alaska Food Policy Council, you would rightfully think that maybe policy is all that they deal with. They do other things like fiscal sponsorship for other organizations who are looking to do food development opportunities. They host a semi-annual conference, which is a big focus of theirs. They engage in a variety of other food-focused projects that aren't necessarily policy-oriented. So this would allow them to work with stakeholders across the state to focus efforts on creating a statewide food strategy.
Fair enough. One more.
You bet.
So the one thing that concerns me, I like this whole concept. Mm-hmm. I like this thing, as you know, because we're
on the caucus.
We're on the caucus together. I'm concerned that there is a lack of discussion in here in transportation. Food security in the state of Alaska, as big as we are, is worthless without transportation, without mm-hmm. fuel for the farmers, without ways to get the trucks mm-hmm. to the villages or airplanes, my favorite subject, or trains. Yeah. So I see that there's one person on the 21 members selected from the distribution or transportation industry, but mm-hmm. I don't see any language that discusses. I would like to see in the six integrated focus areas, mm-hmm. I would like to see a focus on the transportation mechanism to get food from the farmers and to the people. And how are we going to, maybe I'll just leave it at that.
No.
So
through the chair, Rep. McCabe, I agree with you 100%. We weren't as specific, perhaps, as you would have liked. We do specifically mention in the bill the need to focus on infrastructure, which in my mind includes inherently transportation issues. I think depending on how it came together, I would view it as a friendly amendment if someone wanted to better highlight transportation in the bill. You're absolutely right. How we get food that's produced in one area to other areas across the state, if we're talking about better self-sufficiency, a key component is going from A to B. And we do have some pretty exciting examples of some folks who have figured out some piecemeal things and in Bethel, for example, or doing backhaul. So yes, I agree with your assessment.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you. And I would just, I'm going to give my own editorial in case Representative McCabe, who frequently works on amendments, maybe you could broaden that instead of just transportation to logistics, because the cold storage and refrigeration at, you know, farmer transport, but you still need a hub to, that's often an element that has to be figured out. Mm-hmm. Representative Prox, you had your.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Through the chair, are members of the Food Policy Council listed in this list of stakeholders, I guess, members that will comprise this task force?
Through the chair, in your supporting documents with this bill packet, you will see a letter of support from the Alaska Food Policy Council. And if you look on the left-hand margin, it lists all the current members, their name, and I believe their geographic location. In terms of who would serve from the Alaska Food Policy Council in this bill, those members would be selected by the governing board itself. So picking from that group, which would serve on this task force.
Okay. What is confusing to me is that five members from the Alaska Food Policy Council selected by a governing board, and then I wasn't able to figure out just from reading the statute where the governing board was mentioned or the Food Policy Council. So
sure.
Who, in only 2 years, who is going to be in charge of this? Is this pretty well set up and we're codifying something that's already starting up and going, or how's this working out?
Through the chair, so I think I heard a couple questions in there, and I will do my very best to answer them all, and I trust you'll redirect me if I miss any of them. Mm-hmm. In terms of doing this through a statute, we explored different mechanisms, talked with Ledge Legal, and this was one well-utilized option. We actually asked Ledge Research to give us a quick little primer on how this mechanism has been used for similar things in the past, and if you want to geek out over that, I'd be happy to share that with you. But that was the model that we adopted here at their recommendation, because it would allow us to go longer. And we could certainly do another piece of legislation after the end of these 2 years to extend it, which if we look at the Mariculture Task Force, they went 6 years, I believe, and then turned into a nonprofit because they knew their work still wasn't done. In terms of, I hear what you're saying about the governing board and maybe language being not totally clear in there. That definitely refers to the governing board of the Alaska Food Policy Council to select which members best fit for this task force in terms of expertise and time available. And we could certainly clean up that language if that would be helpful. And I may have to ask you to repeat your remaining questions.
Well, are we codifying an effort that is already informally underway?
Are you referring to the governor's task force through the administrative order 331?
Go ahead. Yes.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Start with that, because I was interested in how it's coordinating with the governor's task force. Certainly. And other efforts as
Thank
well.
Thank you for asking, because I really want to talk about that, so I appreciate the question. Yes. through the chair.
I can throw away that note.
Forgive me, Rep. Fox. Did I interrupt you?
No, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. So, yes, for those who could use a refresher, the governor put together and announced, or is still in the process of putting together, but announced the task force through Administrative Order 331. We first heard about that in the State of the State address several weeks ago. Once that is formed, it begins its work, and I do have a copy here. I can share with you what the focus areas of that task force is. That is the, is it the Food Security and Independence Task Force, if I'm getting it right? Yes, Food Security and Independence Task Force. Their final report is due September 2022, so in about 6 months from now. It would conclude in November, so if there's some cleanup work or follow-up, that extra time would allow for that. I can highlight a few ways in which HB 298 and the Strategy Task Force builds off of that, which actually came at the recommendation of the administration. I had the opportunity to meet with the administration and several of the commissioners when he made his announcement. And we had filed our bill, and the recommendation was, hey, I don't think these compete. These build off of one another. This can provide synergy. We'll provide some foundational work between now and September. And as we've seen from other similar focused task force, there's going to be plenty of work to do, and let's figure out with this bill how we can continue that work forward. HB 298 does build and expands a little bit the range of expertise provided, because the focus area of HB 298 is a bit more expanded. Some of the areas that we specifically address in HB 298 to build off of the governor's task force include a food system-wide focus that expands focus to include infrastructure, workforce development, a little more explicit emphasis on urban and rural focus, an emphasized focus on agriculture, which of course is also a focus in the governor's task force, food waste, and improving efficiencies between government agencies. So starting with the administrative order, learning some lessons there, not just in terms of some of the recommendations, but also how it might function, and then building from that with this bill, HB 298.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. To the chair, some of the questions have already been addressed, which is great. I have some more questions just to understand this. So the Food Policy Council, is that a paid council?
No. So this is all of the governing board members are volunteers, and just in the past year, they have hired a part-time executive director to herd the cats.
Okay, so there is a paid element in the council there.
Yes, one part-time member. Mm-hmm. Okay. They would not be eligible to serve on the task force as the bill is written.
Okay. Another question is that the entities, Representative McCabe brought up that, Representative Hannon brought up that, as well as logistics. You know, I see strong need for just this collective piece. Another element is that of three-phase power or electricity to provide to the the services of. So we have transportation, we have storage, power, you know, there's land. Another that I'm hearing a lot from the agricultural is that of, and you mentioned that of storage. And it's not so much maybe that we need to have storage facilities built, but we have storage facilities already in other realms, whether it be large structures at an airport, or I know of a large structure in the Fairbanks Delta area that we're spending a lot of money just having it sit there. But also there are facilities that are used only for a short time, cold storage, and it's used for a certain type of industry. And they've come to me saying, can the state design some database for letting other entities know that this exists? My response to them is the state moves really slow. It's better that you create a database yourself. So in this task force, what are the, is it the intent that the state's got to solve these things, or is it encouraging industry in the state to come together in that as well?
Thank you, Rep. McCarty, through the chair. I think it's in all of the above. The recommendations that the task force are tasked with are thinking through policy, programming, collaborations and synergies that can be found to strengthen the food system. It's not prescriptive necessarily in what that has to look like. I think you've probably heard from Rep. Tarr, for example, that when she speaks with food producers and she asks what can the legislature do, she loves to tell the story to say, get out of my way, please. And I think that's also, that might be part of the solution, right? It's not necessarily which policies do we need. I think the equally important question is which policies need to be fixed or eliminated. And I think all of those are important pieces of the conversation. And it's not simply limited to what the government is doing within their own agencies, which that is a component of the focus area because we could be a very significant consumer of locally produced food, for example. But also, what can we do to foster a healthy business environment so those folks who want to grow the local food economy are in an environment where they can do that?
Okay. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find this discussion fascinating. I'm pleased to see that the Food Policy Council's address is in Homer, which is a great relief to those of us from Anchorage where everything else seems to be based. I'm glad to see, I agree with Representative McCabe about the transportation issue. As a former member of the Resources Committee, I traveled with a contingent to Delta several years ago, and when we learned about the railroad extension that hasn't been extended yet, the Delta folks said, man, we could use that if it's, you know, built for military purposes. But on the backhaul, it takes product from Delta on the railroad instead of the Richardson Highway, which is, apologies to anybody from that part of the state, but that is one of the worst main roads in the state of Alaska. And those poor farmers are transporting their animals and product on that road in, what, one or two trailer truckloads at a time? That's crazy. So, yeah, transportation is a huge issue. I'm glad to see the Commissioner of Education has a designee. Who, does anybody know what the largest food production facility in the state is? I'll save you the guesswork. It's the Anchorage School District Student Nutrition facility, which prepares something on the order of 40,000 meals a day. 40,000 meals a day. It's part of the emergency preparation system for the Anchorage School District. If, depending on when the emergency happens, the school district is responsible for the kids and its care at the particular time of an emergency. So they've got food and all that stuff. But I always thought there could be a way to, and they probably already do utilize Alaska food products, They have the ability to process and preserve and freeze and that sort of thing. So it's good to be pulling together all the different elements. And speaking of large facilities, how about that fish processing plant on, 100th Avenue off Minnesota Drive that used to be a fish processing plant and is now a church? That was a real good plant. So let's focus on assessing what's out there and how to pull it all together. And I think this task force is a great way to do it.
Representative Fox.
Which, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon, segues into, are you going to be inventorying what's available, what has efforts that have been attempted in the past, and figuring out what went right, what went wrong, and going from there? And do we have the right members of the commission to do that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Prox. I would imagine, I won't be chairing this task force, but I would imagine that the individuals with the expertise who will be serving on this task force appreciate, and in fact, I know they appreciate, at least the ones that I've spoken with, the challenges with infrastructure and access to the infrastructure that we currently have, and how having some sort of centralized database would be useful. I know that is on the radar, in fact, of the Alaska Food Policy Council. I know for a fact that's on the radar of Arlie Reynolds at UAF, who's looking at food security programming through the One Health program. So I would expect that this would be something that is consistent with the priorities that will be set by the task force. Again, if we want some more specific language around that, I would support that. I think that's smart. And I think, too, it doesn't say it specifically, but if you look at the language of the bill, we do talk about looking at lessons learned and successful initiatives elsewhere, particularly throughout the circumpolar north, and adapting those here. And I think what you're talking about with the database would probably fall under that broad umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
You have there's no fiscal note to this, and somewhere in there it says that this is all volunteer and no travel expenses or anything like that. But there will be a lot of work and apparently quite a number of meetings.
Through the chair. Oh, excuse me.
Well, I don't know if you can get volunteers. I think it would be difficult to get volunteers, as it were. Somebody's going to pay for this somehow.
Through the chair. Through my 12 years of experience working with stakeholders on issues pertaining to food systems and food security in Alaska, there is no shortage of enthusiasm and desire to serve on these types of groups. People are excited. People are also frustrated, and they want to be part of the solution. That does not give me pause. In terms of the fiscal note, I think that's a fantastic question. We are really keen to see how that all came together as well. A couple things. Because this is a legislative task force, and a good chunk of the executive board is made up of legislators, then those legislators who wish to serve on the task force, it would also be part of the work that their staff engages in. So that would have to be part of their personal and professional calculation of, is this where they want to direct some of their energies. Mm-hmm. In terms of the meetings at this point, and in speaking with the administration, actually, we just ran into Ike in the hallway before this hearing this morning. When we met several weeks ago, and I wish Rep. Rauscher was here on this committee because he could help jog my memory, but the conversation was the administration is supportive of this, as evidenced by his own administrative order, and would like to see this work continue and be absorbed as part of the existing budget and the administrative work that is ongoing. So that explains the zero fiscal note from, help me, Ms. Wiggin. Yes, Legislative Affairs, sorry, still waking up. And as we get further documentation or if it would be helpful to have support from what has been communicated to us by the administration, we could certainly provide that to the committee.
Okay.
I was going to say, is it fair to say, Rep. Snyder, that most of the people, positions designated on your task force are probably in an industry or in a job that would allow them in the course of their work to serve on the task force? So it's not necessarily volunteering off the street and having to take time off of work, but your work in the fisheries-related organization is going to continue to support you serving on this task force. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, I think that's true for many of the positions. It may not be true for all the positions, maybe for producers in particular. But we do have, for those of you who are familiar with the agricultural community here, we have some very involved farmers and producers and processors engaged in the other professional organizations. And I would imagine that those professional organizations facilitate folks applying to serve on this task force.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I was looking at the text of the bill on page 2 in the four members of the Alaska State Legislature section from 5 to 11. I get items A and B, but item C, I think, is looking for an amendment. It says at least one member from the Minority Caucus of the Senate or House of Representatives, which adds up to 5 people, but I think you mean that one, at least one member of A or B shall be from the minority caucus.
Through the chair, we can battle that out with Ledge Legal. That was language directly lifted from, we got this idea in terms of having good representation from previous pieces of legislation. This was the language they used to say, we've got a total of 4 members, but at least one of those has to be from the minority. I agree with you, that wording does not come out real clear here, and if it would be helpful to change that language to reflect the intent again, that works for me.
Paula?
Or in the spirit of the Legislative Food Caucus, or whatever it's being called these days, one member from each caucus in both bodies with two minority caucus representatives and 2 majority caucus representatives, and dispense with that. So, but anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So we have 3 potential task force. So we have the Food Policy Council, the Governor's Task Force, and this proposal here. So how do we, what are we doing to make sure we're not duplicating too much from the other task force? Like, do we have in the, or can it be in the language that we have a member from each of the other task force to come into here as well, so we're not being repetitive?
No. Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I appreciate your focus on streamlining the multiple efforts. I think that's smart. I would say I don't think it's a fair assessment to call the Alaska Food Policy Council itself a task force in the same spirit of what the administrative order from the governor and what this does, as in my response to Representative McCabe. They do a whole suite of many different things, and this is a very focused, concerted effort on developing a statewide food strategy. So it doesn't duplicate necessarily the work of the Alaska Food Policy Council. With respect to streamlining the task force, the Food Security and Independence Task Force from the governor, with this, the idea, and again, this was at the suggestion of the administration, we had the meeting of let's time this in such a way that HB 298 picks up where the administrative order leaves off after their 6 months of work. And there will be plenty of work left. The 6 months of work done will be done also just by happenstance over primary food production and harvesting time. So some of the engagement by some of the folks in the food system may not be as high as we might like, and this provides an opportunity for continued engagement and expansion in the scope. Admittedly, the way this is written would allow, HB 298 would allow technically its work to begin before the administrative orders task force ends. It wouldn't have to by my reading of the language, but it could. And if folks felt more comfortable being more explicit in when the baton is passed and how the baton is passed, I think I would welcome that discussion.
More questions or comments? Okay, if there are no additional questions, the intent is to set this bill aside and bring it back up on Thursday. All right. And, yes, Representative Takada.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor of the bill, I appreciate the efforts being put in to address and look at the structure in the state as far as food in general. I wanted to ask, along the lines of Rep. Prox, to make sure that we're not setting it up to fail, I guess, as far as the zero fiscal note. And mm-hmm. just want to make sure that you're aware that, I mean, if it came to the point of having to put some funding behind this to make sure that we don't hamstring the process right out the gate, that's something that I would entertain. And then I had a question specifically to page 2 as far as the membership going to lines 29 and 30. That's a very pointed way of saying two members from Alaska tribal governments. Can you kind of explain to me what your thoughts were in speaking specifically to intertribal organizations addressing food sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Prokotuk, through the chair. So this bill was written in direct conversation and feedback from the Alaska Food Policy Council, and in particular engaged in this part of the conversation included those members from the Food Policy Council that represent organizations with relationships to tribal governments and tribal organizations whose focus, their work focuses on our more rural areas of Alaska. And I was trying to be responsive to their input to make sure we had broad representation on the task force.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate that. I got the opportunity a month ago or so to address the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and kind of give them an update as far as what we're doing in the legislature and food security, food sovereignty, and food access, all kind of under the umbrella, I think, of food security, was one of their main discussion points. And I just want to make sure that if there was an opportunity for somebody from that organization to serve, that they would, I guess, meet the criteria outlined in subsection 8. So if I come with an amendment later in the next meetings addressing that specifically, know that that's what I'm trying to pursue here. So,
all right. With no more questions, we are intending to have public testimony on 298 on Thursday, and then we'll set an amendment deadline, post that for the following week. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Ms. Chair Wiggin.
I'm sorry I added an S earlier. I cloned you, but
if only.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to transition and continue hearing House Bill 256 this morning. Representative Shragi.
Chair Hannon, I move that the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for HB 256, Work Order Number 32-LS1341-B as a working document.
I will object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Tarr and Mr. Song, please put yourself on the record and walk us through the changes in the proposed committee substitute.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair. Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to join you this morning. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from District 19 in Anchorage.
For the record, David Song, staff to Representative Tarr.
And Madam Co-Chair, just as a quick recap, when we had the first hearing, we had just talked about conversations we had with Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections, and then there was some information shared with us, and the easiest way to refer back to it is we shared that document that has the LEOCA definition, the law enforcement official, and that's the definition of the folks who are reporting into this federal use of force database. And so in response to learning that some of the individuals we have previously had in the bill aren't included in that definition, they've been removed. And so that includes the former 7 section that referred to the Department of Corrections staff. That includes probation officers, parole officers, and correctional officers. So that's been removed. And then in the former Section 8 that followed that, the references to village public safety officers and regional public safety officers were removed. And then the other sort of substantive change there in terms of the other changes aligning with those changes was that in the transition piece of it, it previously, for the employment piece of it, it gave the department just 1 year to work to get all of the municipal correctional officers that aren't currently attending academy and certified through the academy. And we changed that to 2 years because the academy is held in January. And so with that 2 years, that means there'd be time for 2 academies to get everyone compliant. And Madam Co-Chair, there is an explanation of changes document that was submitted, so hopefully folks have that to review.
Madam
Chair. Representative Fakita.
Madam Chair, apologize for missing, I think, the initial hearing on this bill, whenever it was, but can you speak to why some of the sections were removed, for example, Section 8, which pertains to a lot of my district villages.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Representative Puckettuck. And pardon me, I'll just back up just briefly. So the idea here is the FBI recently started collecting use of force data, and, you know, they're trying to get all the states to participate and send their information along, and that way, you know, we'll have the information to aggregate and look at trends. And so this, you know, hopes to bring Alaska in line with that process and get all, you know, in all the ways that we can send that information along. To do that, and hopefully it's in your packet, we learned that the FBI uses this LEOCA that I had mentioned, and so it's the law enforcement official killed and assaulted definition. And so in this definition, the key point that helped, you know, told us to remove a few people was there's a sentence that says they must have full arrest powers. And so the individuals who were removed from the first version are individuals who work in criminal justice and public safety in Alaska but don't have full arrest powers. And so they wouldn't otherwise meet that definition of the individuals who would report into that federal database. And so just at the suggestion of the department, because again, the bill is saying, okay, we're collecting the state data. It'll, you know, there'll be a report to the legislature, but then also to align with that, the federal effort. And so if there's nowhere to send the data because the federal government isn't collecting it, then it didn't make much sense for us to collect it then too.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Representative McCarty.
Thank you, to the chair, and I'm still going through this here, so sorry. So on page 1, mm-hmm. line 13, there's a bit of discussion regarding the word prepared to use deadly force. So I believe that it was suggested as soon as the officer puts on their belt, they're prepared. So what separates that word from maybe some other word of intent, like as they pulled out their gun or something like that, mm-hmm. compared to it could potentially morph into, well, we're not going to allow for someone to have a belt with a gun. They could just have billy clubs, and that's not even good enough. They should have squirt guns, or they should just have good talking points that they pull out.
Madam Co-Chair, and through the Co-Chair to Representative McCarty, I appreciate the suggestion about clarity. I think that we kind of covered that, and I wonder if I could because Ms. Howell from Department of Public Safety is here, because we do have the deadly force definition, and so I know we looked back at that, and I'm just not sure, you know, if I can provide maybe the level of clarity. They would be the ones implementing it, so I'm just hoping that that might help with that. But I think the intention here, you know, and I think, that, like I say, that the clarity in the language is important, is, you know, not to, you know, just consider at every moment that the officer was prepared to use force. But I think she had spoke about in the instances in which they would pull their firearm, for example. And that would be a different level of engagement relative to the way they're trained to respond. But perhaps if I could, Madam Co-Chair,
of course.
Ask her. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. And Representative McCarty, through the chair, I believe since the bill language points to the definition of deadly force, so it does say, sorry, let me refer to the CS, use deadly force or prepared to use deadly force. We go to the definition of deadly force, so that's under 1181-900B16, and it provides examples of what preparing to use deadly force means. It means intentionally discharging or pointing a firearm in the direction of another person or in the direction in which another person is believed to be, and intentionally placing another person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. So it provides examples of what deadly force and preparing to use deadly force mean.
Follow up.
So is it possible that we refer to that statute in this here, so it's not have to duplicate or create something, we just refer right to it? So it's 11.81.
Representative McCarty, McCarty through the chair, I believed that it was referenced. Oh, it is. It is on page 3, line 1. It does reference deadly force definition under 1181-900B.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So on page 2, line 12, I have written down, we were talking about an aggregate report. Or maybe, but anyways, I have notes down to that. What's the thought regarding that piece there rather than prepare a report? Kind of leaves it.
Madam Co-Chair, to Representative McCarty, it's my understanding that the way the information is collected relative to how the FBI collects it, you know, that's the information that would be replicated in that report that we would receive, and that is done in a way that is, you know, de-identified from the individual, but is adding to the overall aggregate data of use of force among law enforcement professionals.
Follow up. So are you then referring that the FBI, it's data entry system for recording this would create the report, really, so there's nothing, a lot of work to create the report, it just hit create report.
Madam Co-Chair and to Representative McCarty, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, I was interested in that conversation about in which an officer used deadly force or prepared to use deadly force, but in each case, in both the CS and the original version, it says against a person immediately after used deadly force against a person. So I'm not sure how putting on your holster in the morning before you leave your home or get into your vehicle uses deadly force against a person. I don't think you're intending to use it against a family member, for example, or the barista where you pick up your coffee. So I'm not sure, I'm not quite sure what that was about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe a little description of the sort of the color codes that we use oftentimes when you're carrying a weapon. You know, you're in green is you're just not paying attention. Yellow is a light heightened caution. Policemen always are in orange, which is the next step higher, which is prepared to do what they must do. So that's where the prepared to use deadly force comes. When a cop goes, jumps in his car, he's prepared, I would think. I would be at all times to use deadly force. My question actually is a little bit different. This would appear to not include the use of a taser, because a taser is not considered, looking at the definition, pulling your taser out and nailing somebody with the taser would not be reportable under this plan, because it's not deadly force. It's not a deadly weapon. It's not designed to cause physical injury. And yet one would think that we would have some reporting. If you're going to pull your taser, you're obviously prepared to, you know, that's the next level below pulling your gun. So I'm curious how we reconcile that, I guess.
So Representative McCabe, through the chair, Kelly Howell again for the record. So the information that would be reported into the FBI is based on what the FBI, what data they consider. So there's the deadly force portion for reporting to a supervisor under APSC. And then there's the use of force data that's reported to the FBI through their use of force data collection program. The use of force data collection program collects use of force events and information related to events where a fatality occurs in connection of use of force by a law enforcement officer, when there's serious bodily injury to a person in connection with use of force by a law enforcement officer, or in the absence of either death or serious bodily injury, when a firearm is discharged by a law enforcement officer or at or in the direction of a person. And then it provides a definition of serious bodily injury, which is under the U.S. code. So the in the context of the bill, the deadly force that's mentioned in Section 1 is in relation to a law enforcement officer reporting to a supervisor when they observe another officer using or preparing to use deadly force against a person. And then there's the information that's required to be reported up to the FBI for the use of force data collection effort. I hope that answers your question.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Howell, thanks, but not really. So my question, maybe I can rephrase it a little. I don't know how you would get past this, but if a cop pulls his taser and fires it at somebody and the little dealies lodge in him and he tips over and quivers around on the ground a bit, that's not reportable to a supervisor, or it is?
Representative McCabe through the chair, thank you for that clarification. Again, Kelly Howell for the record. I don't have my statute book in front of me, but there is a definition in statute under 1181-900 of dangerous instrument. That's included in the definition of deadly force. So if someone is placed in imminent fear of serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, so then we go back to statute and we look at what is serious physical injury and what is dangerous instrument. I believe probably in policy that use of force includes using a taser against someone. I would need to make that connection through the definition of deadly force to confirm that that is indeed the case.
My guess it is. Thanks.
Representative Pakita?
Thank you, Madam Chair. While Ms. Howell is there, going to Section 5, where it talks about how this might interface with VPSOs. Can you speak to that a little bit as far as the VPSO bill that we have kind of going through the building right now? And Section 5 specifically speaks to if the commissioner adopts regulations and how that would work with some of the regulations that you guys are looking to adopt right now based on discussions around just the VPSO program effectiveness in general.
Sure, absolutely. Representative Pukatuk through the chair. Kelly Howell again for the record. So Section 5 of the bill does relate to the training requirements for village public safety officers. My understanding is this is a conforming amendment based on what's being added in Section 1 to kind of renumber that section of statute under APSC statutes for law enforcement training. So this is particularly just a conforming amendment. However, it does state that any regulation or, excuse me, any statutes that are under APSC for minimum training requirements for police officers, that this section relating to VPSOs can be adopted by regulation. So this also, again, is, as you mentioned, there are two bills running on either side dealing with the Village Public Safety Officer Program and VPSO training. And this would complement that in the sense that it refers back to those minimum training standards under the Alaska Police Standards Council.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to remind the committee, all of this discussion was under me objecting to adoption of the committee substitute. And I would like to remove my objection and see if anyone continues to object, or we will have adopted the committee substitute.
We'll have time to.
Oh, yes. Yes, but it just means that's a. Yeah, the CS is now adopted. That makes the official document we are working from. And we do have some people signed up to give public testimony today. And that will have given them a few minutes to perhaps look at the CS. Representative Pakita.
Thank you. Before we switch out folks in the hot seat, I've got to do some homework as far as some of the things that it referenced in Section 2, the statutes that it references, because they're not in the bill, and that's fine. But going to the municipal correction employees, now it not being optional, have we looked at... I don't know how many municipalities have correctional employees. I know that I think my North Slope borough does. I'm not sure about my Northwest Arctic borough. But what kind of burden does that put on those that employ a municipal correction officer to now have to, not by choice anymore, I mean, it's mandating that they shall meet those requirements. Can you talk about that a little bit? I don't know what the requirements are. I don't know if they're already signed up to meet them optionally under ordinance, but I'm just curious about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Good is here from Department of Corrections, and if she wants to join at the table, I will answer, and then if I don't get it all, hopefully she can help fill in the gaps. But there's two sections, Representative Pukatuk, that I want to point you to. So you asked about Section 2, and then if you could also turn to page 4, and then look at the section that's about transitions employment. The Department of Corrections offers an academy where these municipal correctional officers can receive training. That academy happens every January. And so in the original version of the bill on line 11 of the committee substitute where you see it says has 2 years, in the original version of the bill, that was 1 year. And in working with the department, they made the suggestion, because that academy happens every January, that we make that change to 2 years. So that would give the two full academy cycles to get any of the previously not certified municipal correctional employees certified. And then because of that, there's no fiscal note from the department, because they, you know, have the capacity for the group that are currently not going to the academy to come, you know, to the already scheduled academies and work through that way. So, you know, I don't think then it's going to be a burden. You know, these are the correctional employees they would have anyhow, so that employee cost wouldn't change. You know, the benefit is they'll have that additional training, and then that, again, will be able to be provided by the state with the capacity that we have.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Representative, the one word you picked out, though, in that word is shall. And just so you know, it has very, it will have small implication, because majority of the communities right now, those municipal correctional officers already attend our academy. The one you brought up in North Slope Borough already attends. We really only have two communities that we've identified that right now don't use our academy that would under this one, and we don't believe that that will cause any hardship. We have the capacity. They already get training. They just get training somewhere else. So under this bill, future municipal correctional officers will just have to come to our academy, which is already set up.
Ms. Good, since you've identified them, will you let us know? Because otherwise we may hear from them that they don't want to go or why they haven't participated.
Through the chair, to the chair, Bristol Bay and Craig.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you. I think this has been answered, but explicitly, are there new additional training requirements that are imposed on municipalities and everyone else?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, no. This language here only requires that they get the training. The training stays the same. It's 120 hours.
Okay, so where I'm going, well, I guess the next question, are there new fiscal notes coming, or do we have the fiscal notes that we have still apply to the committee substitute? You're not planning on generating another one?
Through the chair, no. We can totally absorb the shall in this bill, and so our fiscal note will remain a zero.
Okay. And follow-up?
Follow-up?
Can the municipalities absorb the cost? There's no cost to the state. I get that. But are we imposing additional costs or a need for personnel on the municipalities?
Through the chair, Kelly Good again, Representative Prox. So these communities in which we're speaking about are community jail recipients, so they get some funding through the state to run their community jails. Part of their budget is training. They already have to train to some degree, so they've got some training funds. It is our anticipation that they'll get those dollars every year for community jails. Their training dollars will then just be used for the academy that we run every January to February. So, no, we don't anticipate there any hardship. They've already got funds to do that.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Yes, follow-up. Thank you, Chair Hannon. So does the same apply then to municipal police departments that might not be running a jail? I'm thinking specifically of Fairbanks and North Pole.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, the language that we're talking about is only municipal correctional officers, so unfortunately I can't speak to the police officer. Maybe the sponsor can.
And Madam Co-Chair and Representative Prox, all of those individuals would already be required to go through the academies for certification prior to, you know, being able to serve. So nothing about that would change here. You know, the one part in the beginning is, you know, a directive for the Alaska Police Standard Council. So that's the group that, you know, does have a new bit of work in terms of doing that beginning part. But as far as that other training, they would be required to attend either the Municipality of Anchorage or the State Trooper Academy are the two in our state that the folks attend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, follow. So, and as I scanned through the supporting documents, it seemed that there's a companion bill in the Senate. Most of those documents were addressed to the Senate. And then most of those documents referred to half a dozen other bills. And I didn't see this specific bill. How does this interface with everything else that everybody's supporting?
Madam Co-Chair and to Representative Prox, I hope that I have the documents that you're talking about in front of me, but there are seven bills that are part of a package that Senator L.V. Gray Jackson worked on over the summer of 2020 and then introduced at the beginning of last session. I was following that legislation and then, you know, just kind of following the progress of it. And so then I put in the companion bills this January at the start of our session. So when you see that's what those are referring to. They are the same bills largely. We have made changes, for example, to this one in adopting a committee substitute. So it would look a little different than the companion in the Senate. But you know, everybody's sort of tracking and taking the feedback, of course, from the departments because we want to work with them. And so that on the other bills, so yes, for example, the First Alaskans, the reference to those other ones, the one that would be most like this is Senate Bill 46, Law Enforcement, Registry Use of Force. That's the companion to the one that we're hearing today, House Bill 256.
Representative Prox.
Okay, and then does this bill incorporate those other seven bills that are referenced in those letters of support?
Madam Co-Chair and to Representative Prox, no. They're very limited in scope, and so this one is just specifically limited to the use of force reporting that aligns us with this FBI process that began just in 2019, I believe. So that's why it's sort of, you know, kind of new to us is that, you know, the FBI just started doing that. We're trying to get everybody synced in and coordinated in terms of the training and then the reporting.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee? All right. So are we ready to go to public? I think we are. So I'm going to thank you, and we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 256 using today's adopted committee substitute as our working document. We have one person signed up here in the room to testify, so we're going to start there. Mr. Don Etheridge, please come forward, put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Chair Hannah. My name is Don Etheridge, and I'm breaking a 27-year rule that I've had of not personally testifying on a piece of legislation that doesn't involve labor. But this is one of them that I'm breaking my own rule in 27 years that I feel that strong about this. I've been looking at all seven of these pieces of legislation that's put in here to tie the cops' hands tighter and tighter and tighter. For the last 2.5 years, I've been a member of a volunteer, the Juneau Citizens Patrol, and I've been out every night for 2.5 years patrolling the streets because of the fact that the crime rate was getting so high. When you talk to an officer and you tell them what's going on, and they'll tell you the name of who's doing it before they ever see them. If you just tell them where it's happened and what's going on, they can tell you. It's the same offenders time after time. And I'm just sick of the idea that we keep tying up the officers' hands more and more all the time. We create more and more paperwork for them to have to do. And yet I don't see a single piece of legislation in the last several years up here that gives them any more strength to put people in jail that are doing things they shouldn't be doing. In the last 2.5 years of patrolling on my own, volunteer time, every night I go out and I'm out 5 or 6 hours every night. I buy my own gas to do it. It costs me about $100 a week to do it. We had 7 robberies in my neighborhood in less than 6 months. And we only way we were able to stop it is we formed our Neighborhood Watch Association. And if somebody comes in the neighborhood, we got about 6 of us out there on the street right now, ready to deal with it. And that's the only way we've been able to stop robberies in my neighborhood. We haven't had a robbery in 2 years now in my neighborhood. Harbors. I really concentrate on harbors because when I first started doing this is the last week's report from the JPD of incidents. When I first started doing this, it was 4 or 5 pages of those that were out there. And instead of tying the hands of the officers and let's give them something to work with so that they can get these guys off the street to keep doing this. When you got to some poor guy down here that's trying to make a living commercial fishing, and they steal $5,000 worth of commercial fishing gear off of his boat that he can't afford to replace. He's got to go borrow money in order to keep his livelihood going. And I just don't think we need to be tying their hands more, giving them more paperwork to do. I think we need to be giving them some support. The comment was made last week about one bad apple gives them all a bad reputation. Well, in all my conversations with people that I've deal with when I'm doing this, their reputation is already going bad for the entire department. Because you ask them, well, why didn't you call the police? Why? They won't do nothing. They can't do nothing. And it's not fair to the officers out there that want to do a good job, that we keep burying them in paperwork. We bury them in regulations that keeps them from being able to get these guys off the street. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Etheridge. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it all right to comment? Offer Mr. Etheridge my thanks.
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Don, for coming to testify and breaking your rule. I formed a neighborhood watch in my neighborhood in 1995, and it helped because I caught a bad guy as he was leaving someone's home that he had just burglarized. It takes eyes on the street. And unfortunately, the police officers can't be our eyes on the street in every neighborhood all the time. There simply are not enough of them. And yeah, they are reactive as opposed to proactive, but I salute you for being proactive and volunteering your time and treasure to do community patrol. That's been in effect for a long time in Anchorage. The community councils support it. And I believe they used to have funding to help defray the costs of gas, as you pointed out, and wear and tear on vehicles. I even think they had vehicles at one time that they had somehow inherited. But it's definitely worth building eyes on the street. And as a former assembly member, I want to offer that the design of our homes does not contribute to eyes on the street. When you have a garage in front of your front door and your front door is way back behind the garage and there's no living room window that looks out on the street or a porch, how do you have eyes on the street unless you sit in your car in your driveway and watch the street? The design of our communities contributes to people staying indoors and paying attention to their own stuff instead of having a way to easily see out on the street. What's happening and who's out there and who belongs there and who doesn't belong there. Neighborhood Watch is a wonderful organization, and I highly recommend it. It helps you get to know your neighbors as well as who belongs there and who doesn't, what their cars look like, who their kids are, who has bicycles and who doesn't. That's what alerted me to the bad guy that I helped nab in 1995, because I knew that my neighbor did not have a bicycle, and this guy left that neighbor's house on a bicycle, and the rest is history. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
That's why I have an $800 camera system set up at my house that watches all the way around my house. I watch my neighbor's house through my camera system because she's all over there all alone. Mm-hmm. And if somebody goes into her driveway, my camera system alerts me that somebody's coming to her house. And I have a 16-foot by 4-foot glass front of my house that looks right out on the street. If somebody comes down my street, I know they're there, and I watch them. And that's what it takes. But people are afraid to do that. I talk to people in the harbors. I said, let's set up a community watch down here. They're afraid to go out of their boats at night when all of this was going on. They were afraid to go out there and confront people. I've had people come at me with a pipe and everything else when I'm out there. I don't go out there unarmed. I did that two nights, and I said, this ain't happening no more. And I go out there, I'm armed, because you just don't know. I've helped bust 3 drug houses. And I run all the drug trade out of the harbors. And you don't do that without people getting really upset with you. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Etheridge. We do have at least one person online, so I'm going to go to Anchorage where we have Crystal Berwick signed up to testify. Crystal, go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Hello, yes, my name is Crystal Berwick, in Anchorage, and calling in support of SB 256, use of force report requirements. I'm pretty disturbed that this is not already done. I really couldn't think of a population that's more vulnerable to abuse of authority than incarcerated persons. It's injustice. The prison, to these people in prison, they are held to a higher standard than the people who are watching over them under the guise of recompense. It's hypocrisy. Consistent policies are needed. If there's information of abuse of authority and excessive use of force are not recorded, then problems in progress cannot be detected. Prisons don't work, and if this bill doesn't go through, it proves that people really don't care if it works or not, and they have no interest in any progress at all. Thank you.
Thank you, and I will let the committee know Ms. Berwick has been with us the entire time we've been in committee this morning. So thank you for being there and being patient to give your short testimony. Is there anyone else online, it seems? And is there anyone else in the room who is seeking to give testimony? All right. I'm going to close public testimony. And that is brings us back to the committee. Is there any more questions or comments? Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Yeah, it would seem, as was pointed out by Mr. Etheridge, that it would be good to make sure that we have input from local police agencies, boots on the ground, if you will, to see if we're going in the right direction here or just adding to a burden. And on the other hand, it would certainly be good to identify more specific problems, targets that we're trying to resolve.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. I concur with the comments from the representative from North Pole. This is not a unique situation just to us in the state. It's all over the country, all over the world. Talking to law enforcement people in Costa Rica and Seattle, down in Phnom Penh, but especially want to refer to that of my experience in Costa Rica, that they would say that the criminal or the person is apprehended would be out the door before the officer had the report done, and they're stuck there. And I'm hearing the same thing in our state, that the mechanisms of reporting is keeping people from being able to be out there patrolling. And if we're incapacitating through documentation, then it's going to create more of a problem because we don't have people out there on the street. In the case of our community patrol, fortunately, they don't have to document all sorts of things like that so they can stay on the street. And it's interesting, in those communities that I went to, that the community patrol was what kept the communities safe. And my experience, as an example, just in the past couple of years in Seattle, that the law enforcement individuals were on a state of a learned helplessness. They just kind of gave up doing their piece, but they really weren't going after people because of the intense amount of paperwork that they have to do, as well as they weren't given the privilege to do what they were trained to do. And that's a sad statement there. So as we look at documentation is what are different means that we could do that to expedite the process, but not incapacitate our community constables, you know, just helping out the people. And definitely that of community watch, I think everybody, this is, you know, everybody needs to be watching out for one another because we're a small community. And I appreciate those in the community watch in my neighborhood. In fact, they're so good that when I drive away from my house, I've even got a call saying my taillight's out on my truck. And so I say, I appreciate that. Thank you. I'll take care of it right away. That doesn't mean that we are like micromanaging details of someone's life. It's just we're watching out for one another. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no additional hands or questions, we will set this bill aside for today. We will take it again up again on Thursday. As has been previously announced, amendments for this bill are due to my office by 4 p.m. tomorrow. Our next committee meeting of Community and Regional Affairs is scheduled for Thursday, March 17th at 8 a.m. We'll note that is St. Patrick's Day for a couple of members of the caucus, I'm sure you, or the committee, that you will need to note that day. Representative Prox.
Before we adjourn.
Yes, I'm getting ready to adjourn.
Okay,
so.
Very good. So we've got, by my count, 32 bills. We've taken care of a couple of them. I'm just wondering if we could get some sort of an idea of which bills have hearing requests and where we intend to go get a direction so I can be a little bit more prepared than I was today.
I'm not sure if you want to just know what's on the schedule for next week. The Co-Chair Shragi and I meet on Wednesdays.
Okay.
We do have things scheduled out for about 3 weeks at this point.
Okay. Is that schedule available?
Well, it's one of those that once you basis
change.
Things are subject to change. Basis only allows you, and the notification is 1 week out. We have the Department of Corrections up for 2 days of hearings. Is it next week?
Put your hand in, and then we also have a presentation from DCCED, which is legislatively required, as well as a number of other bills scheduled. And we can discuss anyone that's put in a hearing request. We can make sure that we communicate to them when their bill is scheduled.
Right.
And just as a reminder, again, if I may, Co-Chair.
Please.
If you turned in a hearing request last year, just to be abundantly clear, I know it's been said a number of times, but if you turned it in last year, you need to turn in another hearing request for this year, as has been the policy. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Frankly, that hasn't been the policy until this year. So it was a problem for us because we didn't know that. So at least that's what pretty much all the senior staff is saying. This is the first year that this has been in place.
Well, it was a written notification sent to all members of the House early in January that committee hearing requests needed to be carried over and requested. I would say the majority of people sent in requests right away. You were, Ms. Good, were you trying to hand signal me? You're next week. I just couldn't quite remember because we have been doing, you might imagine that coordinating, especially with agencies or specific people. So for instance, we had Ms. Sandy here, you know, coordinating with their office to make sure it was on a calendar. We do that further in advance than a week. So by the time it's noticed on Thursday for the next week, we've probably been in communication with those folks for 2 weeks about it. So we have been scheduling about 3 weeks out. And I knew we have a full week with corrections, and then we've got a statutorily mandated hearing with Department of Commerce, Community and Regional Affairs rule.
Economic development
that's required to be given. And in general, that has to be, you know, we want to do that before any confirmation votes, and then we'll be back on some bills again.
Okay.
All right. Representative Prox.
Well, just to say I appreciate the challenge of the committee chairs of coordinating all of this. I get it. There's 400-something bills total. But there was some criticism on the floor of lack of participation or whatever, things that should have been taken care of in committee. Point was well taken. Yesterday's floor session did drag on a little long, and hopefully we can stay ahead of it a little better, be more informed, be more prepared for committee meetings. That's all. That's the whole point of it. But thank you.
Representative Tarr, you were.
Madam Chair, is there just one thing I could get on the record as you close out on House Bill 256? Just the list of agencies that are already participating in terms of reporting, and we'll send this list out. Alaska Department of Public Safety, Anchorage Police Department, Bethel Police Department, Cordova, Fairbanks, Haines, Homer, Juneau, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Palmer, Petersburg, Seward, Soldotna, University, Valdez, and Wasilla. So we'll send that list out. So there are a large number of agencies participating at this time, and if I'll follow up with your office, Representative Crox, to get the more specific question, or you know, make sure we can get the more specific question answered that you had. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. No more questions or comments? Representative Drummond.
I just want to say that yesterday, after, when did we leave the floor? 9-something?
30.
Yeah, I was grateful, and I noted to my co-chair of education, Andy Story, that as much as I hate getting up for 8 o'clock meetings, I'm so glad that we get our work done before floor. And the same applies to this committee. So focusing on the work that we do before we ever go to floor really helps work get done in this committee. And the closer we get to the end of the session, the less likely it is that we may be able to meet in the mornings on every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Well, and you are, of course, the most senior member on this committee, been in the legislature longest, but I will note that, you know, in my second term, one of the things is the morning committees are disrupted by the subcommittee process because that takes it up to get the budget out. The afternoon committees are disrupted once floor sessions start being going, and I know that Chair Puckatuck and at least two of us serve on his committee where he's had extensive legwork done to have presentations at agencies, and they get disrupted. And yesterday we were to have confirmation hearings for a number of people and appointments. So once you've delayed that, you've also delayed a number of public members, and to get them all rescheduled for another hearing is a huge logistical nightmare. So every committee sort of has to deal with it. Morning committees have to deal with the subcommittee process disrupting their committee time, and the afternoon committees, it's floor session disruptions. So it's all about the logistics of trying to make the schedules work.
And the ripple effect for the next 2 weeks.
Right. Well, right. Yeah. So all this good planning, and then, yeah. But we are less likely at the 8 a.m. on Tuesdays 30s to have floor disruptions until about 3 or 4 weeks from now. And then, of course, all bars are off and the floor could take all day, every day.
Wouldn't it be horrible to be in the majority?
Are we?
Terrible.
Everybody wants to wind you. Like you have the authority to make something different. You know, I.
Yeah. Sarcasm.
Can we close out? It would be great to shut off the meeting today. Thank you. There we go.